The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Treatment Advances and Individualized Therapeutic Strategies in Prostate Cancer, Expert Insights on Key Evidence, Practical Tips for Personalized Therapy, and Clinical Integration Approaches. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/CJD860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the program today. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. I'm Neil Shore. I'm the medical director of Carolina Urologic Research Center in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I'm a uro-oncologist, and it's a true pleasure to be able to share the program today with my dear friend and colleague, Alicia Morgans. Alicia is a genitourinary medical oncologist from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. Alicia, great to see you and so glad you're here.
Thank you so much, Neil. Really glad to be here.
So this is an educational activity, and our title today is Treatment Advances and Individualized Therapeutic Strategies in Prostate Cancer, Expert Insights on Key Evidence, Practical Tips for Personalized Therapy and Clinical Integration Approaches. And so you're hearing within the title, there's a lot of strategy towards personalization, precision-based care. And I think also embedded in that are so many advances that have happened. Really, we used to say maybe over the last 5 or 10 years, but now it's really within the last year and 2 years. So a lot of really important things to be thinking about. Our goals today are to describe the rationale and evidence for contemporaneous modern-day treatment options in the management of, for patients with prostate cancer. And so we always want to make sure that whether you're in the community, in a metropolitan area, urban, rural, suburban, or in a tertiary academic center, we want to really, as clinicians, I think we would all agree that we want to make sure we're able to have that really full discussion with our patients of all the available therapies and the data that supports them. And so our goal additionally will be to equip you with some strategies and some tips and tricks and pearls, so to speak, on various, you know, therapeutic regimens. We're going to be starting off with localized disease and sensitive biochemical recurrence. We're going to talk about MHSPC, but then, of course, get into the important area of resistant biology and the many different ways of sequencing and combining therapies. And throughout that entire prostate cancer continuum, we always want to think about risk-benefit ratio and the adverse reaction profile. And so we often call these treatment-related adverse events. And how do we educate our patients, their caregivers, our colleagues, our allied health personnel, so that we can do the best job that we can? So there are just so many really remarkably interesting and novel and new things that are coming into today's clinic and how we make decisions, and understanding and that there is an art of medicine, but there's also level one evidence and there's different adverse reaction profiles. So Alicia, my question for you is, how do we counsel our colleagues on the factors that are involved in making a decision?
It's a great question. And I think I consider the main things to think about cancer-related factors, clinician-related factors, treatment-related factors, and patient-related factors. And, you know, these include things like extent of disease, the way that the cancer has progressed, if we're getting into mCRPC, de novo versus recurrent, if we're in the hormone-sensitive setting. And these are really cancer-related factors, as well as those molecular features that we definitely need to test for. Patient-related factors might be the burdens that they're considering and the things that they need to deal with, social supports, their preferences and beliefs, but also their comorbidities and their con meds, because they certainly come into play. Treatment-related factors really has to do with what's available at our sites, whether we have access, the cost of different treatments, and whether patients can actually afford to go on them. And then clinician-related factors affect all of us, and sometimes in ways that we don't realize. They may be our understanding of the data, our experience with the medication, and even our comfort managing certain adverse events. I think, you know, as we're considering treatment decision-making, shared decisions with patients is so important in educating patients so that they can participate in a way where they feel very confident and supported to do so is critical. And we have to know that the information that we're providing to patients is reputable. And we do know that, importantly, that sometimes there are resources online that are actually just not reputable. So ZeroCancer.org, Zero, which is a prostate cancer advocacy organization, does provide information for patients that is reviewed, curated, and we know to be truth, updated regularly to make sure that it stays updated in the truth. And there are other websites as well, like the American Cancer Society and Prostate Cancer Foundation, but ensuring we talk to patients about which sites might provide real and reliable information, I think, is a critical part of that process.
Okay, well, that was, you know, spot on. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, truth and organizations having a reputable background. And, you know, we live in this world where we get a lot of different things on social media, and a lot of it's just very inaccurate. So it's really great to go to a resource that is trusted. And I certainly look forward to the fact that, you know, science has always had our own, you know, standards. And I think these organizations like Zero really follow with that. So let's move on to a discussion about some of the new data that we have going from high-risk localized disease all the way to biochemical recurrence. And then you're going to take us home later on and what all the really exciting things going on in castration-resistant disease. But when we think about high-risk localized prostate cancer or locally advanced prostate cancer, this is the very challenging group. And this is the group that we're not curing if we do an active intervention, prostatectomy, radiation, brachy, and external beam, one or the other, various forms, even an interest in some parts of the world with focal therapies. And our patients who have high PSAs, high Gleason scores, or what we now really have uniformly started to call the grade group. So those who are grade group 4 and 5, those who have palpable abnormal exams, clinically the T3s, where we're concerned that there's margin expansion. You know, we worry about these patients because you can see that their 15-year prostate cancer specific mortality can be relatively low. So, and then the bar graph on the left is essentially showing you how patients who have higher risk features are going to, you know, have a poor prognosis. And so it's 20 to 40% or even 20 to 50% of these patients, with our best intention, we don't cure them. And then they go on to have recurrent disease. And then that sets off the motion of systemic therapies invariably and eventually going from sensitive biology to resistant biology. As you see here, even with definitive therapy in the top bullet, we still have a very significant number of patients who will have a rising PSA afterwards. And so that is pretty much a foreshadowing of a recurrent disease. And sometimes we can image it and see where it is, and sometimes we can't. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But prior to the upcoming data that I'm going to show you about the EMBARK trial, we had really very limited level one evidence for what to do with these patients with BCR, and we're going to address that today. And as you saw in that earlier slide, the high-risk biochemical recurrence, PSA relapse, is highly predictive of radiographic progression and ultimately symptomatology. And then it sets off this entire cascade of antineoplastic therapy. So not only a burden on patients, but a major burden on the healthcare system. Good news is we have a lot of great therapies to keep those patients enjoying the quality of life they want to, prolonging their survival, ideally keeping them out of the hospital and out of the emergency department. Because here's all of these really wonderful, prospective, globally conducted trials demonstrating that for patients with low and high volume metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, treatment intensification, no longer just using monotherapy ADT, is the way to go. That's the intervention column you see. The control was invariably monotherapy ADT with the exception of the triplet trials, Aricens and PEACE 1, where the control was ADT and six cycles of docetaxel. The triplets added darolutamide for Aricens and abiraterone in PEACE 1. The doublets, as you see above, whether it was with Stampede, different arms, Latitude, Arches, Enzimet, Titan, these were wonderful and very important studies looking at novel hormonal agents or androgen receptor targeted agents, whatever acronym you prefer, clearly demonstrating, showing superiority of the doublet or the couplet to the monotherapy ADT. Now, without getting into the weeds of these trials, you should know them by now because these all happened and were reported on several years ago, almost all of them in New England papers, and they're all incorporated in pathways and guidelines throughout the world. One of the frustrating questions and things is we still see a fair number of practitioners still using monotherapy ADT. And maybe it's because there's an access issue. Maybe it's because they still don't fully understand all the data. Maybe they're not comfortable with the adverse reaction profile. But I think it's not a reach to say we have to do better. And when it comes to these MHSPC patients, probably easily north of 80, 85%, maybe there's a small percentage that you may want to just do ADT alone who are maybe very fragile, frail, have many other comorbidities, but I think it's a small percentage. Now, this is an important study, and it was published in Lancet. First author is Gert Attard, and this was really one of the first studies to show that for patients with high-risk localized disease, so that with conventional imaging, no evidence of disease outside the prostate, and patients were selected here with high-risk features, typically high PSAs, grade group 4s and 5s. They were going to select androgen deprivation therapy and radiation, and ostensibly for 3 years of ADT. And really what the trial looked at was, would adding abiraterone, acetate, and prednisone benefit these patients? There was also a combination arm of abiraterone and enzalutamide. But at the end of the day, this is a very important study. So for patients who have high-risk localized features who are going to elect to have radiation therapy and ADT, adding abiraterone acetate with prednisone clearly bested the control arm that only had ADT and radiation. I think this is extremely important because this is another way where intensification is going to delay recurrence, is going to also improve survival for these patients. Now, we have other trials that are out there. I'm proud to be part of this trial, the ATLAS trial. I'm on a site. We've completed accrual. I'm on the steering committee for this. And I think this is an important study, whereas it's essentially taking a similar population of very high-risk patients, typically grade 4 or 5s, high PSAs, and you see the eligibility criteria in the far left. But at the end of the day, we're randomizing radiation therapy and ADT with apalutamide versus radiation therapy and placebo. There's a little bit of a run-in with bicalutamide, but that's only for a very short period of time. This is a very important study. There's a similar study out there, very similar study schema with enzalutamide, and there's even another one out there with darolutamide. So I think for the high-risk localized, especially for patients, these are all for patients who are going to get radiation therapy, we can do better. We've seen that in the Stampede study that I showed you a second ago, and we have three other androgen receptor pathway inhibitor trials that will read out within the next, year to 18 months. Now, what about our prostatectomy patients? Again, I'm proud to be part of this study. This is the Proteus, or some may pronounce it Proteus. And we've never really had level one evidence telling us that neoadjuvant therapy benefits long-term in terms of disease-free survival, recurrence, and certainly not overall survival. And this is a large global phase three trial where we had patients with high-risk disease who were randomized to getting a neoadjuvant therapy for 6 months, apalutamide and ADT versus placebo and ADT, have their prostatectomy. If they have certain criteria for PSA nadir, they'll go on to another 6 months of adjuvant therapy APA ADT versus placebo ADT. And I think this could be a very compelling and noteworthy study. We don't have the readout yet, but this is something that we really want to see. Again, does intensification help our surgical interventions? So let me move over to from high-risk localized to the biochemical recurrence. And here's the EMBARK trial. We presented this in the spring of 2023 and then published in New England in October 2023. And by November, and I'll show you a slide on this in a second, the data was compelling enough that the FDA expanded the label indication for using enzalutamide with LHRH as well as enzalutamide monotherapy. So we're very proud of the patients and the sites that were involved in this study. The eligibility criteria was you had surgery or radiation to try and cure localized disease, or you could have had both, but you had a biochemical recurrence. You had to have had a doubling time of less than or equal to 9 months. So high-risk patients, typically that's consistent with a biology that's been well-described previously, that more faster doubling times, more likely to develop radiographic evidence of recurrence. Three-arm trial, you see it listed here, 355 approximately in each arm, LHRH and ENZA versus LHRH and placebo versus just an unblinded enzalutamide monotherapy arm of 160 milligrams, which is the approved dose across the entire spectrum of prostate cancer from CRPC, NMCRPC, and MHSBC. So now this is the only androgen receptor targeted agent now approved for biochemical recurrence. Now, we had a kind of a fun thing, which I think so for all of us, was a de-intensification in this green vertical bar. If you nadir to less than 0.2 nanogram per ml, you were able to enjoy a treatment holiday. In other words, stop therapy of any of the three arms, and so you could get that suspension. If you had surgery and your PSA went over 2, or your PSA went over 5 in the radiation arm, you reinitiated therapy. If you never got below 0.2, you remained on treatment. Here's the KM, kind of the take home, looking at the combination arm of ENZA and LHRH versus LHRH alone. And one can see the curve separating at about a year and a half, 3 years. You see the delta, 5 years as well. The hazard ratio, which is demonstrated here, which was 0.42 and highly statistically significant, favoring combination over monotherapy LHRH. So that was the primary endpoint. Looking at just the PSA, PFS, the combination versus mono, I mean, the combination is almost a horizontal line across, I mean, really deep and profound long-term stabilization of PSA in comparison to the monotherapy luprolide with a hazard ratio of 0.07. we saw a similar signal coming out on this in the trial that was called the Presto trial that was looking at apalutamide, that same really impressive PSA-PFS using an AR pathway inhibitor. When we looked at that third unblinded single oral monotherapy arm of enzalutamide, the approved dose, lo and behold, enza monotherapy bested LHRH therapy alone with a hazard ratio of 0.63 and the p-value you see listed there. So I think this was really one of the really nice things about the study, and the FDA appreciated this, and that's why there's a label expansion that allowing us to offer patients these two new options that are that clearly were better than LHRH monotherapy alone. You can see the percentages here of serious AEs, dose reductions, and permanent, and unfortunately, sort of a real paucity of AEs leading to death. Here in the U.S., it has led to this very significant label expansion for patients who can now be offered enzalutamide in combination with LHRH or enzalutamide monotherapy for high-risk biochemical recurrence. Now, we presented this at ASCO GU, and we looked at the impact of the treatment suspension. Again, the arms were pretty much balanced. 86% were able to get this suspension or this treatment holiday versus 67%. This is based upon PSA going below 0.2. And even the patients on the combination versus the LHRH alone, there was a difference there of 16.8 versus 9.6%. And that remained pretty, favoring the combination over time. So what I really like about this is it gives us this ability to have an intensification, then de-intensification conversation with our patients. And I think patients really like that. It gives them a sense of control, but knowing that they're having control and arguably not negatively impacting their disease progression. And let me ask you, Alicia, you've now had an opportunity. Let's just maybe start with high-risk localized disease. Patient comes to you and says, I just don't want surgery for whatever reason. I want to go with radiation. How do you talk with them about taking on abiraterone acetate now? How do you, make that conversation one that's understandable to patients? Because now they're not only going to have radiation, but they're going to have some form of T suppression as well as or a novel hormonal agent in the form of abiraterone.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that we've done increasingly is actually increase our use of PSMA PET in that setting. And so we actually have a number of patients who move from a surgical sort of plan to a radiation plan with intensified ADT and abiraterone because they have PSMA PET identified lymph nodes in the pelvic region. And what I think is important to acknowledge is that this is not a population that was included in STAMPEDE. STAMPEDE really included patients who had radiographic evidence of nodes on conventional imaging. And then, of course, 2 out of 3 of those high risk factors that you described. But as we are integrating these new imaging technologies, that turns into a major driver for our use of intensified therapy with abiraterone in this setting. I think once we show patients that we can see pelvic lymph nodes, it's a pretty easy conversation because they're then concerned that the cancer's moved outside of the prostate and very interested in doing everything they can. The other thing I think, aside from that, in patients who meet the other criteria, Gleason score, high PSA, which is actually less common, or that T3 disease or greater, when I talk to them about intensifying, it's not adding a large amount in terms of symptom burden for the most part when we're talking about abiraterone. And there are pills that you take. You have to take that low dose of prednisone, But I don't think from a quality of life perspective, it is dramatically different than taking your GnRH agonist or antagonist alone. So it's not been a major hurdle for most patients who are interested in radiation. I do think that it'll be so interesting. The Proteus trial is really going to change the conversation again in that high-risk localized setting. And I think it's going to be even more interesting to talk about the use of systemic therapy in a surgical population, because one of the reasons patients gravitate to prostatectomy is that they have the opportunity and hope that they may not need systemic therapy. So that's going to be interesting. And those results are highly anticipated. And I know you participate, we participate in that study. Really, really eager to see that come through.
I agree with you. And that's where I guess as a tip for the audience is, and enrolling patients in the study, we were the first patient in, the last patient in, which is kind of an interesting kind of a bookend at our site. And you're absolutely right. You know, there's sort of this exigency, urgency, I'm going to do this. I want to do it yesterday. Let's get my prostate out and be done with it. But, you know, in talking to those patients, I did share with them that, you know, unfortunately, yes, we have great surgeons, and yes, we think we have great results in terms of recuperation, but we want to augment the success rate, getting back to that 20 to 40, 20 to 50% failure rate. And so, you know, and I hope, we don't know yet. We want Proteus to be positive. We'll wait and see. But you're right. I think it's going to take education and conversation. Okay, well, thank you. And let's switching a gear for a minute. Let's talk about prostate-specific membrane antigen. What is PSMA? It's this transmembrane protein. It's intra and extracellular, which not only is very highly expressed throughout the continuum of prostate cancer patient, it is also expressed in vascularity in the GI tract and in renal tubules, but largely in prostate malignancy. So not only have we been able to leverage it as an imaging modality, but also as a therapeutic when we can add a linker to it and a payload. I'll show you a slide on that in a second. And this is a beta particle. There's an entirety of a field looking at alpha radioligand therapies. And so this is a very exciting area. You see the timeline here at the bottom, but here is a nice, cartoon pictorial of what radioligand therapy is. And so you have lutetium PSMA-617. It binds to the extracellular expression of PSMA. It's transcellular, so it goes intracellular, and it has attached to it the lutetium payload. You see that really kind of right in the center, and that gets endocytized, and then the lutetium acts as this DNA damage repair and apoptotic effect on cellular proliferation. The schema for the VISION trial is listed here. Again, you see these are heavily pretreated patients. It's a 2-to-1 randomization and ultimately a successful trial. Here's the Kaplan-Meier on the far right. You look at the RPFS benefit here, a little over a 5-month benefit in radiographic progression-free survival, hazard ratio of 0.4. Overall survival benefit of 4 months and a hazard ratio of 0.62. But that was the VISION. That was in post-chemotherapy mCRPC. The FOUR trial, which the results were preliminarily presented at ESMO 2023. We haven't published it yet. This was in a pre-chemotherapy mCRPC group. You see the eligibility criteria here. You just had to have had progressed after an NHA, but no chemotherapy. Now, importantly, in VISION as well as in FOUR, you had to have had a PSMA PET. The control arm here was switching or sequencing from the ARPI from one to the next, invariably Abby to Enza or Enza to Abby. And so what we see, there was a high crossover, about 84% of the sequencing of NHA did cross over, and get cycles of lutetium-617. But here is the really nice results that were presented for the primary endpoint being RPFS. This was the primary endpoint. So this was a clearly successful study, hazard ratio of 0.43, curve separating, you know, right or a little after 2 months. Here's the OS slide. We're going to see a third OS. Again, I mentioned it. It's important to recognize 84% crossover and patients who were discontinued who had radiographic progression. So we'll see what happens with the third cut point on the OS. PSMA4, if you look at not only the RPFS, but one looks at best response and soft tissue, again, the orange is the sequencing. The purple-blue is the patients receiving lutetium 6 cycles, 6 weeks apart, typically administered by a nuclear medicine radiologist or a radiation oncologist. Complete response rates, you see that delta, partial response, stability of disease, a partial decrease, all favoring the lutetium versus the sequencing. So I think that's very encouraging. No new safety signals from what we learned in Vision. Radiopharmaceutical drugs, they go into the cortical bone. They can go into potentially into the marrow. So you have to be cognizant of myelosuppression. Therefore, a CBC is always checked before each administration, particularly focusing on hemoglobin, less so, but also importantly on platelets and white blood cell count. You can get salivary gland impact, and so it tends to be mild and reversible, but it is something that one needs to be aware of, as well as admonition about when you receive therapy. There are some different guidelines depending upon where you are in the world of precautions. But overall, in the U.S., this was done as an outpatient basis, not inpatient, and just good general universal precautions in terms of bodily waste to have appropriate precautions. Some mild precautions about traveling on a plane within a 24-hour period. So are we going to be able to move this class of drugs earlier? And here is the interesting study known as the ADDITION study, which we've also participated in along with FOUR, along with VISION, and now in ADDITION. And so we've completed accrual. You can see the stratification here is getting a standard of care, which is an ADT and an ARPI versus an ADT, ARPI, and 6 cycles of lutetium-617, primary endpoint, RPFS. I think this is exciting as we're always trying, as we talked about in the earlier doublets and triplets, to advance and improve our effects. Now, this is just, and you can read the fine print later, but we presented a poster on this at ASCO GU this year, a large database of over 1,500 patients. And what was really interesting, and this is real world data, it's claims based, and it's pharmaceutical-based, so there's always some limitations and caveats along that. But interestingly, up to 40% of patients were receiving, in real-world evidence, lutetium-617 and MCRPC after an NHA and not after taxane-based therapy. I thought that was really interesting. We see really consistent PSA reductions. That's really that third bullet on the bottom. So just to kind of conclude, I really like this space so much because it's very unique, novel mechanism of action. The good news is that, it's effective because PSMA is highly overexpressed in prostate cancer patients. We're also able to use it as a sort of a screen, as a biomarker, and also as an improved imaging agent for our patients, especially with high-risk localized disease, as well as with biochemical recurrence, and now a therapeutic target. There are other, beta particles that are going to be being tested. but also alpha particles in the form of actinium. I think it's a very exciting time. Lutetium PSMA-617 is the only FDA-approved agent right now based upon a phase 3 trial for patients post-ARPI and taxane, and it was clearly bested the control arm. We'll see what happens in pre-chemotherapy mCRPC and the mHSPC. I think it's a very exciting area, but it really brings into the importance of working together, you know, medical oncologists, urologists, with their radiation oncologists and nuclear medicine radiologists. So I think it's ultimately really good for patients. Do you think that the role for RLT will eventually get, you know, integrated and percolated out into the community? I know academic tertiary centers have pretty much uniformly embraced it.
I do think that it will. I think that there are centers, particularly in some of the more rural areas, that are ramping up. And I work a lot with teams in Maine because they're not geographically, well, we're probably the most close geographic area as a city, Boston, that they have to access lutetium PSMA-617. Not that we're necessarily close, because we have patients who still live 6+ hours away, because Maine is a really, really large state. But I think that I'm really excited because there is a center in Maine that is ramping up and hopefully will be open and be able to deliver lutetium PSMA-617 at some point in the next year or so. And I anticipate that this is going to continue, you know, across the country to really ensure that patients have access closer to home, because it is not tenable to expect people in the long term to drive such long distances. And especially when they have advanced disease, it can be really, really difficult. And, you know, shared decision making, as we think about it, is certainly considering those kinds of barriers, and understanding proximity, availability, and those kinds of things is really critical. It is important to know that there are decision aids that are downloadable, that are available, so that people can review those and have support through education so that they can better participate in shared decision making. And Zero is a great resource, as we've said before, as are others, including Prostate Cancer Foundation and the American Cancer Society.
Okay, well, that was great. I agree with you. I really think Zero does a phenomenal job in putting out updates in all their literature, which I think is really nice. I know PCF does a really good job of that as well. Let's go over and talk about what's happening now in resistant disease.
Great. So when we think about some of the updates in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, I think our hormonal therapy plus PARP combinations have been really some of the big news in the last couple of years. And I think PARP inhibitors in general have been really useful. And we've increasingly been doing genetic testing, both germline and somatic genetic testing, in our patients with prostate cancer to understand when we might have patients who have one of those DNA repair defects that might be targetable by something like olaparib or rucaparib based on their approvals as monotherapy. And now in the first line mCRPC setting, we might be able to use combinations of olaparib and abiraterone, niraparib and abiraterone, or talazoparib and enzalutamide, as those are also recently approved all in 2023. To think about genetic testing, though, a little bit more broadly, I think we have to acknowledge that it does take a team to make this happen. And certainly, even if we're not doing most of the testing in-house in our centers, which is normal to do a lot of send-outs for these, we have to have strategies and standardized operating procedures about how we're going to get this done, because we know now that germline genetic testing is actually recommended in guidelines for any patient with metastatic disease, and actually even for patients with high-risk and very high-risk localized disease. So large populations that are recommended for testing regardless of family history. In addition, patients who are of Ashkenazi Jewish descent have a family history of something like a BRCA mutation or a Lynch syndrome mutation, or when patients have at least two first-degree family members who have one of the afflicted or associated cancers, even when they have lower risk disease, they should be getting germline genetic testing. Somatic tumor testing is also recommended for patients who have metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. And that's really to help us understand, again, the extent of options available for treatment. These are approved medications, and they include the PARP inhibitors, PARP combinations, as well as pembrolizumab. So making sure that we're looking for DNA repair defect mutations, as well as Lynch syndrome mutations, thinking about tumor mutational burden and MSI high status is really, really important. So getting our systems in place, getting our teams in place to do this testing on a routine, systematic basis is critical to understand the options. We do know that we have room to improve here. So HRR testing patterns in the real world have been studied and recently presented in a patient cohort with metastatic CRPC. And in this group, and this you were really leading this group, Neil, they found that 40% of patients with mCRPC didn't have germline or somatic testing, and about 33% or a third of those patients who were HRR mutation positive actually never received a PARP inhibitor. And when we understand how aggressive, how poor the prognosis is for patients with some of the HRR mutations in particular, particularly BRCA2, BRCA1, it is so critical to give them the opportunity to have a PARP inhibitor when we know that the PARP inhibitors can so dramatically improve their outcomes. So really clearly an unmet need here that we as a field are continuing to address. So the approvals that I mentioned previously have been based on several registration trials, and we'll go through the big three that led to those approvals in 2023. PROPEL is the first that we'll talk about. This was a first-line mCRPC setting study in which patients had progression of disease without prior exposure to abiraterone. They could have had docetaxel previously and no ongoing progression or ongoing treatment or progression of disease on other novel hormonal agents. And all of these patients could have had any mutational status. So it was an all-comers type of a study, just first-line mCRPC. So patients are randomized one-to-one to receive treatment with abiraterone and placebo or abiraterone and olaparib. And I want to emphasize that abiraterone in this first-line setting in patients who had not been exposed to treatment with an NHA and had progression is absolutely a standard of care and is a highly, highly active control arm. So this was a high bar to pass here when we added olaparib to abiraterone, particularly because it was an all-comer study. What we saw, and this is pulling out the BRCA mutation patient population, is that those patients who had BRCA mutations had really significant improvement in progression-free survival when olaparib was added to abiraterone in that first-line mCRPC setting versus abiraterone alone. Those curves separate beautifully. They separate quickly. And we can see here that the hazard ratio is 0.24. So really critical that this patient population has access to a PARP as we see such an improvement here in PFS in the BRCA mutation population. This, as I said, led to approval. And here we have the final overall survival data that is not mature based on endpoints or events, I should say, but was mature in terms of timing of reporting this overall survival. There will be an update at some point in the future, but this data suggests we can see a trend here, but this did not reach statistical significance. There were not sufficient events to drive this analysis. So we'll wait to see more here. Magnitude is the second study of combination treatment that I will present. And importantly, this study is designed a little bit differently. These patients, again, had first-line mCRPC. They could have had exposure to docetaxel chemotherapy for hormone-sensitive disease, and they could have had prior abiraterone for a few months prior to enrollment. But patients actually had biomarker status screening prior to randomization, and you could see that they were actually allocated based on their biomarker into cohort one, which is a biomarker positive population, or cohort two, which was a biomarker negative population. And within those cohorts, they were randomized to treatment with abiraterone with or without niraparib. So again, in this first line setting in patients who had not progressed on a prior novel hormonal agent, this is a highly active control, a high bar to pass. So what we can see for the biomarker negative population is that this cohort study was actually stopped for futility because there was no clear benefit in progression-free survival to the addition of niraparib or with niraparib to abiraterone in this setting. But in the biomarker-positive population, there was a very clear advantage. So here we can see radiographic progression-free survival in the BRCA subgroup of patients treated with abiraterone with niraparib, showing an advantage versus those patients treated with abiraterone alone, highly positive control. And this also was approved as a combination treatment here in 2023. This is actually interesting, a single pill for this combination of abiraterone and niraparib rather than being separate prescriptions. Here we can see the final analysis and updated overall survival unadjusted on the left. And then we can see here the time to symptomatic progression and time to cytotoxic chemotherapy all being improved with the addition of niraparib to abiraterone in this biomarker selected population. And so TALAPRO-2, also a study in the first-line mCRPC setting. This is another all-comers population, but this population did have an understanding of the biomarker prior to enrollment randomization, or prior to randomization, I should say. So mCRPC, patients who are randomized here 1:1 to receive treatment with enzalutamide with or without talazoparib and followed again for radiographic progression-free survival. And here we can see that when we added talazoparib to enzalutamide, we have an improvement in progression-free survival. Also important to recognize here that enzalutamide in a patient population that has not had progression of disease on a novel hormonal agent previously is going to be highly active. So this was another high bar, although some patients did have exposure to novel hormonal agents in the CSPC setting. But this is the PFS curve here. And here's the overall survival curve, not yet mature, and this is in the HR deficient setting. So I should really clarify that all of these combinations are in restricted and identified cohorts. The abiraterone-olaparib combination is approved in first-line mCRPC for patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. The Akiga niraparib and abiraterone combination is approved for first-line mCRPC in patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2. And patients who have HRR mutations can receive enzalutamide and talazoparib in this first-line mCRPC setting. And importantly, I would say also, there is a lot of ongoing research. Here are some phase 3 studies looking at using these combinations in earlier stage disease, metastatic hormone-sensitive disease, both in the Amplitude trial and the TALAPRO-3 trial. So we will see how these combinations do in earlier disease settings. When we are using PARP inhibitors, I think it's really important to make sure that we understand the safety profiles. These are oral agents, but they still are cytotoxic agents in a way. They are targeted, but they cause cytopenia. So here we can see that things like anemia, thrombocytopenia are important for us to recognize. And we do have to follow CBCs while patients are getting treatment. They can also have GI effects and fatigue, and extremely rarely MDS-AML, PE thromboembolism. And I think we're still, you know, continuing to follow studies to understand the extent to which these are going to be problems. They don't seem to be very frequent events in the follow-up that we have at present. And so to continue on, I think we are still trying to extend our reach and understanding of combination approaches. And there are several approaches that I'd like to just address here. And one of the more recently reported has been a TKI-IO combination in prostate cancer. And this is something that has been developed over the last few years. And the rationale is that angiogenesis and evading immune response are certainly things that we know cancer cells do. And VEGF TKIs can really address the angiogenesis piece of that and affect the microenvironment, whereas immunotherapies that target PD-1 or PD-L1 might be able to affect the immune evasion aspect of cancer, cancer proliferation. And TKIs can really, as I said, be important here for that microenvironment effect, which might make something like immunotherapy that is normally ineffective in this setting, perhaps not newly effective because of those microenvironment effects. So we had early evidence that this might be a successful strategy in the COSMIC-021 study. This was a phase 1b that was reported several years ago, which suggested, as you can see in the waterfall plot on the right, that patients who had mCRPC who were treated with cabozantinib and atezolizumab may have a decrease in their measurable disease. And I would say, importantly, this population was selected to have measurable disease on scans as measurable and assessed by RECIST criteria, not bone-only disease. And this is based on a history of cabozantinib causing some bone lesions to appear to essentially go away on bone scans, even though the disease was perhaps not meaningfully affected in terms of its overall trajectory. So the CONTACT 2 phase 3 study was more recently reported. This included patients with mCRPC who, again, had this RECIST measurable disease. They had prior treatment with one novel hormonal therapy in the castration-sensitive setting. They had a good performance status, and they were randomized to treatment with cabozantinib and atezolizumab versus physician's choice of abiraterone or enzalutamide, which would typically be the AR signaling inhibitor that had not been used in the previous setting. They were followed for a primary endpoint of progression-free survival and overall survival. And here we can see the progression-free survival in the intention-to-treat population, demonstrating this hazard ratio of 0.65. This was highly statistically significant. So there was a PFS benefit that was demonstrated here. I think really interestingly, that benefit seemed to be most pronounced among patients with liver metastases, those who had received prior docetaxel chemotherapy, and the overall survival data is not yet mature. So I think this is really interesting. We see about a 2-month improvement in median progression-free survival, and we absolutely are waiting to see where this will go. And here we can see another way of considering this data, the disease control rate, which includes stable disease as well as complete responses, anything less than real progression of disease. So PR, CR, and stable disease, really suggesting that benefit in terms of disease control with the combination versus the second novel hormonal therapy. When we think about managing adverse events in this setting, we have two agents that may have some overlapping toxicities, and one strategy is really to hold the TKI. It's hard to hold an infusion that you give every few weeks, and so you'd have to get to that next treatment in order to hold it, but you can hold the TKI, which is an oral agent and is given at home, so you do have a little more control there. And if symptoms resolve while you're doing that, you know that the symptoms that you're affecting, whether it's rash or perhaps diarrhea, probably related to the TKI, and it helps you to understand which is causing which. I think it's really important to know that there are other multi-targeted TKIs and IOs that are being tested in mCRPC, and zanzalintinib is one that is being tested, and we can see here that it has similar target profile to cabozantinib, but has some properties that make it a little bit different. It's being tested in the phase 1 STELLAR studies. There are multiple cohorts that are being looked at in mCRPC. So really exciting to consider this in combination with IO and see where this goes. So, Neil, there are so many things being developed. I think as a urologist, you have to talk to your patients about all of these things and consider enrolling them on clinical trials. And I know you and your team are incredibly active in clinical trials. How do you talk to your patients about them and about getting involved in research?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I will say it was ASCO was really one of the first to say and put it out there in their literature that a clinical trial is a standard of care. And if we're not offering clinical trials, then we're, giving up on the ability to change clinical practice. I tell patients that. And, one of the common refrains is, oh, I don't want to be a guinea pig. Well, you're not being a guinea pig. You're getting really incredibly detailed review of your care, a scrutiny that you would never get typically or compensated for by most payers. So you're treated with incredible respect and care. And I also tell patients that, you're not signing a 30-year mortgage contract. You're only in the trial as long as we see that this trial is benefiting you, or at the very least, you're not being harmed. You always have ability to move to something else. And I always explain to patients what all the approved indications are in addition to the clinical trial. I never have a patient sign on to a clinical trial the same day we talk about it. We have them go home with the consent form, talk to family members, and then come back, we tell them, we give them various websites to go to as well. So, I mean, for me, honestly, it's been really one of the most rewarding aspects of my career to be able to offer patients these studies, because that's how you change clinical practice. And it's not just in prostate cancer, it's pretty much in everything. I know the folks at Zero do a great job of promoting the importance of clinical trials. Clinicaltrials.gov, a website, folks can find out all the trials that are available to them and where the trial sites are. So there's so many great things. And of course, for our patients who've exhausted or can't tolerate the approved therapies, trials, you know, give a lot of optionality, so to speak, and personalization to their care. So I really loved how you know, reviewed some of these really important trials, Alicia, and it really, again, speaks to the importance of the multidisciplinary team and, you know, virtual tumor boards, how we can talk to each other on a very regular basis, whether it's texting throughout the day to your trusted medical oncologist, your trusted radonc, nuke med, pharmacist, social worker, geneticist. You brought up some great points on the underutilization of genetic testing. And, you know, sites like Zero, they really have it out there, and they curate regularly. And so you can really put your, you know, have your patients go to a site like Zero and get great information. And if I don't have a trial, I always am encouraging my patients to go to a place that, you know, is appealing to them.
I agree. You know, the one final thing I would mention is that patients learn from other patients. And so, you know, like you said, giving patients the consent, giving them the opportunity to take it home, talk to family about it, but they may also talk to other patients. And one of the things that Zero does have is an opportunity to connect with support groups and folks online who can be other sources of truth and help support them, encourage them, as you said, to, you know, get involved in clinical research, because I just find it fascinating. Patients who are on a clinical trial inevitably do better than patients in the same clinical situation, but out in the real world getting standard of care. And it's because of all the support and all of the care and appreciation. And then just one more comment on the multidisciplinary care. You know, it is so important for us to have that good connection. Every time I talk to colleagues that I know are doing this well, they're always talking exactly as you did about their ability to text, to reach out, to make sure that they have access to what their patients need. And if it's not at their own site, to help connect them with someone else. And we use that shared decision-making process. We use that conversation with patients to understand what they need so we can get it for them.
Well, yeah, I thank you for putting that together so nicely. And, you know, people talk about burnout, but boy, it's so rewarding to be able to offer our colleagues and our patients and their families cutting edge new therapies that can really change the healthcare system. There's so much evidence that supports not only the multidisciplinary approach to prostate cancer, localized to very advanced, but that there's a lot of new things that are out there. And that's, to me, really one of the joys of being not only a researcher, but to be an active a clinician. And so we want to be able to continue that really, you know, privileged ability to have an individualized care for patients and the art of medicine. So thank you very much, Alicia, for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Neil, for inviting me to be here. It was truly great to be here. And I want to remind everyone to please remember to download the practice aids associated with this educational activity as a resource for you, for your staff, for your patients. And we really hope that you found this activity informative and useful for your practice. And we thank you for your attention.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. This activity is developed with our educational partner, Zero Prostate Cancer. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/CJD860. This educational activity is supported by medical education grants from Astellas and Pfizer Incorporated, Exelixis Incorporated, Janssen Biotech Incorporated, administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation.